Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the second in our series on Women of Faith Contributions to Our History. Today's topic is Elizabeth Clay Watkins, mother of Henry Clay, the great statesman from Kentucky. About a year and a half ago, Eric Harrison had the idea for this seminar series. He created it. And he organized it, and he asked me to do Elizabeth Clay Watkins. And I didn't know quite how to respond, because I knew nothing about her. I knew about Henry Clay. I've been to his home, Ashland, in Kentucky. But I just had to think a little bit, did a little bit of research, and decided that this would be a most interesting topic, although we don't know much about her. Still, it was a challenge. So I did the basic research, and then I lived with Elizabeth for about a year in my head, and I thought about her times and religion in her times and politics, what was going on in the world, and I just kind of let that whirl around in my brain. And then 6 months ago, I started really digging into her life, and I think that what I have found out will give us some things to discuss. We'll have plenty of time for discussion, and that's one of the points that Eric made when he organized the series, is that these are topics that we need to have some conversation around. So I promise that there'll be discussion. And the handout is merely just a frame of reference. It's essentially notes if you get confused with all the dates and names, and it's something to take home with you. We certainly won't go through it as part of the hour. But first, let's open with prayer. Gracious God, thank you for bringing us here today to learn and grow in knowledge and in our faith, so that we can be better servants in your kingdom. In Jesus' name, amen. We're going to call her Elizabeth. We could call her Mrs. Clay or Mrs. Watkins, but I feel like she's Elizabeth. So Elizabeth's life spanned the time before, during, and after the Revolutionary War. And this is what we need to keep in mind throughout the hour. When she lived, she died in 1829. So she's not so much a figure of the 19th century as of the 18th century. And while we don't know much about her, we can draw on history to put together a picture of her life in Virginia and later in Kentucky. In my research, the most interesting source I found was the Clay Family Archive, put together in the late 19th century. This is now available online if you want to read more. It was published by the Filson Club of Kentucky. This is the oldest privately funded historical society in Kentucky. It's now called the Filson Historical Society. It has a beautiful big building in Louisville, so it's still active. It was founded in 1884. And in 1899, their 14th publication was the Clay Family Archive. And part of the reasoning behind this was to set some of the record straight regarding Henry Clay, who had become almost a saint in Kentucky. He had died in 1852. And so decades after his death, this historical society wanted to clarify some things. Henry Clay himself and his early biographers had represented him as being of lowly origin. He proclaimed himself a self-made man, and that's actually the origin of that term in our vocabulary. But this was not true, far from true. He had a privileged upbringing, although he was born in 1777 and was, in his words, rocked in the cradle of the Revolution. Clay's tale of a hardscrabble childhood probably secured votes during his candidacies, but it was far from true and probably not fair to his family and particularly to his mother. The preface to the Clay Family Archive attempts to set the record straight, especially in regard to Clay and his mother. Henry Clay was of gentle birth, with parents on both sides possessing not only valuable landed estates and numerous slaves, but occupying high social positions. Indeed, he could look back upon a long line of ancestors from whom descended a family record worthy of being inherited. The unapproachable eminence attained by Henry Clay as an orator and statesman has made everything connected with him almost sacred. He has made us want to know something about everyone bearing his name, everyone in whose veins flows the Clay blood. We would know all that can be learned of his nearest of kin, and especially of that fortunate woman who brought him into the world, a mother who could give birth to such a son as Henry Clay deserves universal remembrance. But has this mother been awarded such remembrance? They think not, and they set about remembering her, which we will do this morning. And I'm sure you noticed that the language is very much of the late 19th century, and you can enjoy it or find it a little bit over the top, but it's the closest thing we have to a primary source. First, we'll talk about Elizabeth in Virginia. Elizabeth Hudson was born in Hanover County, Virginia, in 1750. When she was 15 years old, she married the Reverend John Clay. He was a Baptist farmer preacher in Henrico County, and then later they moved back to Hanover County as a couple. This was near Richmond. The dual role of preacher and farmer comes because the preaching didn't bring income, and this is preaching as a Baptist. Clay was a successful farmer who owned over 20 slaves. He provided his family with a comfortable life until his death at about age 39. He and Elizabeth had 9 children. The main question is, where did the Baptist come from? The first John Clay settled in Jamestown in 1613, so we can assume that most, if not all, of his ancestors were Anglican, which was the official religion of colonial Virginia. How to answer this? I think we need to look at the context of Baptist in Virginia. The official religion was Anglican, and so Baptists were considered dissenters. And their churches were small and loosely organized, but they were not persecuted. Virginia's parish county form of government was tolerant to dissenting churches. So John Clay and his wife Elizabeth and their family certainly didn't suffer because they were Baptist. First, a little bit of religious background of this time. Beginning in the 1730s, this is before Elizabeth was born, religious diversity increased in Virginia with colonists coming in from the Northeast, including Presbyterians, lots of Presbyterians, Baptists, and Lutherans. They were assimilated into the parish county structure even though they were religious dissenters, and they could all worship freely. It's like the Anglicans said, we'll just leave you alone, you worship. Evangelical energy grew in Virginia as early as the 1740s in what appeared to be a spontaneous spiritual awakening in Hanover City. This is part of the large religious revival known as the First Great Awakening, which started in New England and it was just filtering down. The emphasis was on an individual's experience of new birth as a test of genuine Christianity, and on converting others, even if they had already professed faith in Christ. This sounds familiar from many evangelicals today. Each denomination, including Anglicans, think Methodist, had a more traditional branch and a more evangelical one. For Presbyterians, it was the old light and the new light. For the Baptist, it was the growth of separate Baptists in the 15 years before the Revolutionary War. And this was during the time that John Clay was coming of age and making decisions about his adult life. The preachers were often uneducated and self-appointed. Their religious brand was exuberant, unbridled, and at times defiant. It was an experiential religion, an emotional religion. We don't know which approach John Clay took, the more traditional Baptist or the separate Baptist. But he was a well-to-do farmer who was probably educated, so my guess was that he took a tamer approach. But he has been described as an evangelical zealot, so he could have been a separate Baptist. Unfortunately, we don't know. But for just a minute, back to the parish county government. All dissenters, evangelical or not, were parishioners. They were legally liable for all responsibilities and obligations, such as taxes, except for attending church. They were left alone to worship freely, as we've said, and also, as parishioners, they benefited from the generous assistance given to the poor, sick, handicapped, and orphaned. Their social services were pretty good by our standards. The parish county form of government really worked for colonial Virginia, and I'm sure it worked well for the Clay family. I'd like to turn now to another role that Elizabeth had, and this is beyond that of wife and mother. She was a patriot during the Revolutionary War. In fact, Elizabeth and her older sister were strong and spunky rebels, this is according to the archive, while their father was a Tory. They brought aid and comfort to the struggling patriots, young women giving their all for the cause. Elizabeth's grandson wrote in a letter from 1894, "She had often taken a servant and pack horse and traveled for miles from home, carrying provisions to the American soldiers. She often ordered the servants to throw apples, potatoes, and other lighter food supplies across the river near her house to the pickets and scouts of the Patriot Army when in that vicinity. But she also protected herself and her family. The grandson noted that when the enemy occupied and foraged the country, she had at times to bury from sight her bacon, provisions, and other things of value." Clearly, the war was difficult for everyone. For Elizabeth, the impressions of these days of peril stayed vividly with her to the end of her life. The Clay Family Archive includes two accounts as heard from the lips of Mrs. Clay herself when she was elderly. Here's an excerpt from Mrs. Lucy Trabue, a neighbor. This takes place the night of John Clay's burial, when British forces known as Tarleton's troopers came to that area and came to the farm, and you know they were up to no good. "Not satisfied with supplies of food for themselves and provender for their horses, they wantonly destroyed the widow's property, at the same time taunting her with brutal jibes and insults. When the detachment of loyalist troopers were seen approaching, there was but one white male person present, the overseer of the plantation. At the insistence of Mrs. Clay, he escaped by the back way and eluded capture. The soldiers, a number of whom were recruits from the country, unceremoniously entered the house and began their brutal work. They first ransacked the kitchen and larder and satisfied their hunger. Next, they turned their attention to the destruction of the furniture and to general pillage. Bureaus were chopped to pieces, trunks and chests broken open, and every room and closet ransacked for such articles of value as were portable. Other property which the vandals could not well carry off was wantonly wrecked and scattered about the house. 100 years ago, it was the custom of our grand dames to provide a fat feather tick and a straw tick for each bed and to alternate these for winter and summer. After breaking up the bed frames, the roistering troopers ripped open half a dozen of these feather ticks and emptied their contents out the windows. The air was so thick with flying feathers as with leaves from the forest after an autumn frost. The remorseless raiders finally rode off with their stolen booty, to which they added scores of chickens and turkeys which they had killed. They carried off with them a number of the slaves of the plantation, how many we may know not. Another excerpt, this from her grandson, gives us some insight into her character. During the Tarleton raid, one of the men threatened to, or did, thrust his sword into the new-made grave. Elizabeth complained to Tarleton about this villainous treatment of a helpless woman. He told her to point out the guilty, and he would have them punished. She reprimanded him roundly and told him he knew it was impossible for her, during so much confusion, to point out the guilty. They were all strangers to her and dressed alike. He then paid her a sack of coins for her losses. She emptied the sack on a table, afraid to openly refuse the money. But when Tarleton left, she scraped it off into her apron and cast it into the fire, saying her hand should not be polluted with British gold. So that's Elizabeth during the Revolutionary War. Things did settle down for her. The war ended, and in 1784, she married Henry Watkins. He was a Virginia planter, and he had been a captain in the militia. He was 26 years old, and she was 33. You can imagine why Elizabeth was relieved to remarry a younger man, no less, and to start a new life later in Kentucky. Interestingly, Elizabeth married her brother-in-law. Her older sister, Mary, had married John Watkins. Elizabeth married Henry Watkins, who was described by a friend as an elegant, accomplished gentleman of good blood and goodly wealth. Here's where the Kentucky thread begins. John and Mary had moved to the Kentucky Territory and begun to establish themselves at some point in the 1780s. It was natural to invite Henry and Elizabeth to join them in 1792 when Kentucky became a state. John was a founder of the town of Versailles in Woodford County near Lexington, and he was active in politics. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention at Danville and served as a representative in the first Kentucky legislature. So Henry and Elizabeth were probably happy in Virginia. They had, I think, 7 more children, and they were obviously well off. But this was a very, very interesting opportunity, and I just think in my heart that Elizabeth wanted to go somewhere else. And they certainly already had a place in society there. The town of Versailles had just been founded when Elizabeth and Henry came, and they do pronounce it Versailles, even though it's named after Versailles. Just like Western Pennsylvania. Turning from farming to innkeeping, they opened the Watkins Tavern, which served food and drink and provided rooms to travelers. Although Versailles had a population well under 200, it was on the way to the flourishing city of Lexington, and the area in general was growing quickly. Watkins Tavern was the only hotel in Versailles at that time. It was successful, and the couple was happy. Henry Clay had stayed in Richmond, Virginia, to study law. They left him there when he was 14. Some people think this is kind of terrible, but it was actually pretty normal for the time, and Henry Watkins made sure he was well taken care of. When he finished his law studies at age 20 in 1797, he moved to Lexington. Sometime after 1815, Elizabeth and Henry retired to a nearby farm, which they had purchased before 1797. It had about 1,000 acres, and they had 11 slaves and 5 horses. Also during this time, Henry served as Justice of the Peace for Woodford County, and the courthouse was right next door to the tavern, so that was quite convenient. Now, we must talk about Elizabeth the person. I'm sure you've been waiting to hear some details about her. Unfortunately, we know nothing about her as a young person. No descriptions have survived, and no images have survived from her entire life. But we do have these recollections of her as an older woman, and I think they're quite revealing. Her grandson wrote, "She was rather below the medium in stature and of well-rounded form, dark hair and eyes and ruddy complexion. She was a woman of great determination, industrious and economical." And this from the archive. The neighbor, Mrs. Trabue, remembered Mrs. Clay Watkins as a very entertaining conversationalist. The flush of resentment would animate her features and flash from her eyes as she would recall the memories of these desecrations enacted at the sacred shrine of home and over the remains of her dead husband, but barely cold beneath the sod. She remembered one incident not related by others, over which the heroic matron dwelt with more than the usual pathos. Among the things of value which her chest were rifled was her wedding dress, made of white satin and richly trimmed, and no doubt from the artist hands of some famous maker in London or Paris. It was a relic treasured with a tenderness of sentiment and pride which only a good woman can know who has been a bride, and beyond all earthly price to her alone. The ruffian who stole the endeared relic was an officer. He threw it across his saddle and mounted. The last wistful view of the beautiful robe was as he rode away, not to return. Mrs. Trabue said that as the venerable matron would come to this incident of her narrative, her voice would tremble with tenderer emotion, while tears would fill her eyes and trickle down her cheeks. A lawyer wrote this when he was 91 in 1893. Traditions well agree in their description of the person and character of Elizabeth Clay Watkins as she was remembered in her daily life. Her dark hair and eyes, relieved by a light shading of complexion with a flush of crimson on her cheeks, leaves the impression that she was not distinctly brunette or blonde as a type of comely womanhood, but perhaps a blending of the two. She was possessed of strong Anglo-Saxon sense, with great determination of will, and was noted for the orderly industry and thrift with which she conducted her domestic affairs. The writers of the Clay Family Archive indulge in some heartfelt hyperbole to conclude their discussion of Elizabeth. She was engaging in manners, entertaining in conversation, and a great favorite in social circles. Her individuality was striking and impressive. She was animated and genial in spirit, and readily won the confidence and esteem of others. She spoke with the authority of self-conscious right, yet always with disinterested sympathy in all that concerned her friends. She was not only respected, but much reverenced by those who knew her intimately. In her home life, she was hospitable and kind to all, and sympathetic and responsive to every call of need among her neighbors. Though somewhat strict in her discipline with her children and servants, she was just and kind, and both paid to her the tribute of obedience with respectful devotion. The mother of Henry Clay was undoubtedly a woman gifted by nature and of a marked individuality wrought out in the school of a many-sided life experience. She was possessed of traits of mind and a force of will and character which made her not only equal to every occasion, but in emergencies superior to environment. We reverently honor her memory as the mother of the great. She was not less one of the heroic women of our country's destiny. In the days of peril, when our country needed heroines as well as heroes, posterity should not do less than remember the deeds of such and make their names imperishable in our literature and upon the pages of history. We can assume that Elizabeth Clay Watkins was a saint, I think. At this point, we've heard enough about what we really, really know about Elizabeth Clay Watkins, and I'd like to know what you're thinking of, and we'll just take the conversation from here. We can go in a number of different directions. John.
Any information about her relationship with Henry?
Yes, it was very, very good, very, very warm, and on his way to Lexington in 1797, he stopped and visited the family and appreciated their encouragement, enthusiasm, support for him launching his career. Lexington was really not very far, so he was able to visit them a lot. And apparently, while he was studying in Richmond, he did visit on a number of occasions, but it was quite a trip across the mountains, so I'm not exactly sure how often that happened. But he chose Lexington for settling down because, of course, that was the city where if you wanted to succeed as a lawyer, that's where you would go. But he liked being close to his family, his mother. And when he went to Lexington, one of his brothers, a Clay, was already there, and later another one came. So I think they were a pretty close-knit family. Three of the original children survived to adulthood, and of the second batch, the Watkins children, four survived to adulthood. So that I guess that was pretty normal for the time. But let me read you the epitaph on Elizabeth's monument. She was buried when she died in 1829. She was buried at her farm, and later Henry had her moved to the cemetery in Lexington, and he put up a lovely gravestone, and it reads this way. This monument, a tribute to her many domestic virtues, has been prompted by the filial affection and veneration of one of her grateful sons, H. Clay. So I guess that answers your question. Eric?
Yeah, just sort of a side anecdote. The general that she got rated, Tarleton, had the reputation as the most vicious of all British generals.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, he was. And for her to talk back to him?
Yeah.
She really was spunky, I think.
Straight
yeah, yeah. Yeah. John?
If I add correctly, she had 16 children.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, of course,
right. But that was I tell you what, I had three.
Yeah.
And she was 33 when she married Henry Watkins. And I mean, you know, as you get older, it gets harder. Yeah, yeah. So she must have been a strong constitution. Yes.
Well,
Mrs. Trabue, who grew up near her as a neighbor in her later life, but I didn't find any evidence. There's just really very, very little information. I think she and her sister were very close, her older sister Mary, because they worked together, they grew up, they worked together as patriots during the war, and then when they moved to Kentucky, you knew that that relationship continued in the small town of Versailles. Ted?
What was the nature of her
tavern?
Was this a rocking place?
No, I said it was innkeeping. It really was a hotel. You know, back then they were called taverns, but they did drink. And, you know, Kentucky, bourbon, whiskey was around in the 18th century, and there was no prohibitions against it. That came a little bit later. And even bourbon was around in the 1700s, but it didn't get its name until a little bit later. You know, Woodford County, Woodford Reserve, bourbon. I mean, it's kind of like the bourbon county capital of the world.
Along those lines, I've always heard the story. I think there's truth to it. Rye whiskey was made in this area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
The process for making what we call bourbon is the same as rye whiskey.
Right, right.
It's made from corn.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
All those people that were making bourbon actually came, or many of them, from Western Pennsylvania.
And I think that included a number of Presbyterians.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I think most of the settlers came from Pennsylvania, Virginia, and North Carolina. So, to settle that part. And a lot came from Virginia, and so from what I read, I think the two Watkins families felt a kind of familiar culture, like the Virginia Circle was active in their new little society. But Kentucky was known as the dark and bloody ground, and it was a place of robbing, drinking, brawling, and it was a little bit wild, but I think by the time they got there, things were starting to even out and become what we would call civilized. Lexington was growing very, very fast, the largest city west of the Alleghenies, and you could buy goods from Europe and other places there. And Elizabeth did not, she certainly didn't spin her own yarn or make cloth or anything. She bought her materials and she had the funds to do that. I mean, she was definitely a lady, that's for sure. Any other ideas in your head?
When family events, they have a lot of children, entertainment, holidays,
There's no information about that, but I would imagine when they were running the tavern, they would use that, and then later at their farmhouse. I don't know. They had a lovely home in Hanover County, Virginia. It was a kind of like what we would call a Cape Cod, 1.5 stories, nice house. And but I don't know what their house was like in Kentucky. The tavern, there's a picture of it on your handout. It was stone. Well, one of the things that interested me was the coincidence of the Watkins being in Kentucky and getting settled and the Second Great Awakening. How many of you have heard of the Second Great Awakening? Cane Ridge, Kentucky. Well, the First Great Awakening was successful, and it brought a lot of evangelical energy. But then the Revolutionary War came, and the people at least attending churches and religious services really, really dropped off. And, of course, those were terrible times, and it took a long time to kind of recover from that. But by 1800, there was this kind of united, almost, series of revivals that were happening all over the place, and the climactic event happened to be in Cane Ridge, Kentucky. There was a Cane Ridge meeting house, and this was just 37 miles from Versailles. And I can only believe that if she didn't attend this, she certainly knew about it, because owning a tavern, you would hear all the latest news, and I know they got a lot of travelers. Well, this revival was a huge event. All of these were like big camp meetings, and it started on Friday or Saturday and ended on Sunday or Monday or even later, and they were very emotional. People would come from all over. They would come up from North Carolina to these big meetings modeled on the Scottish communion services that were held once a year outside. You're probably familiar with that. They only took communion once a year, and everybody came from all over, and it was almost like a big party. Well, this was a lot like that, but with a lot of this fiery preaching and emotion. And the Cane Ridge Association has a web page, and on that there's a little bit of history. And the accounts talk about the contagious fervor which characterized these meetings day and night. And I can read you an excerpt from that that sort of describes what it was like. Descriptions abound of individuals taken by great emotion, falling to the ground, crying aloud in prayer and song, and rising to exhort and assist others in their responses to the moment. Worship continued well into the week following the serving of communion on Sunday. In fact, until provisions for humans and horses ran out. So I guess they just kept going until they couldn't go anymore. And this is the model for the camp meetings that developed in the later 19th century. You think of the Chautauquas, and we have Chautauqua. It started out as a big camp meeting. So this is where it all started, right in Elizabeth Clay Watkins' backyard. And interestingly, the Cane Ridge area, which had one of the first meeting houses, religious, in that area of Kentucky when it was still a territory, was settled by a group of Scots-Irish Presbyterians from North Carolina. And as you probably know, North Carolina had lots of Presbyterians. We're like second after this part of Pennsylvania. So that's no surprise. But guess who advised them to go and start new lives in this part of Kentucky? Who might have? Who lived in North Carolina and did a lot of work in Kentucky, put it that way, and then later lived in Kentucky? Anybody want to take a guess? You got it. Daniel Boone. Yes, yes. In fact, Daniel Boone, under the direction of Captain Richard Henderson, who was who actually bought land in Kentucky, made the trip in the 18th century to settle land, to make roads, and so forth. And Richard Henderson is actually one of my ancestors, believe it or not. But he's quite famous in Kentucky, and so is Daniel Boone. But Daniel Boone happened to start off in North Carolina in the town where Ted and I lived for 11 years, Hillsboro. And there's this great little arrowhead right on the main street that says, Daniel Boone left from here. So, and he left and came back many, many times. Apparently, he was just a rough and ready guy, but he was originally from Western Pennsylvania. So, see, it's just everything connects in our little world of Presbyterianism. Yes, Eric.
Yeah, on the Henry Clay's movement for emancipation, which interestingly began in your description in 1798, quite a few years before abolitionism started in New England. Is there any indication of Elizabeth's impact on his frame of mind and his disposition in this direction?
Actually, the reality of all that is that Henry Clay wasn't much of an abolitionist. He did advocate for the gradual emancipation of slaves over time, but it was never one of his issues. He did have a distant second cousin, Cassius Marcellus Clay, who died in 1903, who was a famous abolitionist in Kentucky. But Henry held on to his slaves, and after his death, they were freed. And he did free two slaves later, nearer the end of his life, but this was after they sued him in court in Washington, D.C. for their freedom, and Henry won the lawsuit. He later freed them. But slavery was a way of life, and I imagine that Elizabeth did not even think about it as something wrong. That's just how life was, and they couldn't run their farms without slaves. I would like to think, and from all evidence, that both Henry Clay and his mother treated slaves well. And there's no evidence to think otherwise, although you hear that a lot. Oh, yes, they were well treated. I don't know. But he had 60 slaves at Ashland in Kentucky. So if he had that many slaves, I don't think you could really say he worked hard for abolition.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, and that's something else I couldn't find. I think that there was basic education for women, but it was all done in the home with tutors and, you know, just the typical 18th century thing. She was just a child of the very proper 18th century, and I'm sure she learned to read and learned to do needlework and learned to take care of a home. And yeah. So, and I imagine John Clay was educated, as I said, but I don't know. Sandy?
Was there a connection to Henry Clay
birth? I can't find one. I don't know if he was named after Henry Clay, but considering the time frame, that's very possible because he was very famous in the 19th century. But I did look that up. Anybody know? I couldn't find any evidence that there's a connection. But I did. I do realize that some people around Pittsburgh have heard of Henry Clay Frick and haven't heard of Henry Clay. So I'm wondering a little bit about how our education in the schools is going. Marilyn. You know, I didn't do a whole lot of work on that because I wanted to focus on Elizabeth. I tried to discipline myself so that I wouldn't get into that, but I think he had a rather happy family life. Henry Clay was an odd duck, though. He was very bright and very good at conversation. People loved him. He was great at a party, except sometimes his wit went a little bit too far and he would offend people. He was a little bit too quick with the sharp attack, but he was a good orator, and it just came naturally, and I wonder if he inherited that from his father, the preacher. I don't know, but he, I don't know quite how to put this, but even he admitted that he didn't study as broadly and as deeply as he should have when he had the chance. He was so clever and so gifted, and I think you know people like this who are so smart that they just don't really need to study. And I think the general consensus is if he had been more broadly read, that his career would have been more successful and he might have been one of our presidents. But it held him back just a little bit. Although he was obviously very bright. And he studied under George Wythe, think of the Marshall Wythe School of Law at William and Mary. And that's who taught Thomas Jefferson. So, you know, he hobnobbed with the fanciest people in Richmond. And he also learned social skills there, for what that's worth. And I think that helped him in his political career, too.
He was a candidate for president four times.
I know, and he didn't win. And even he admitted, if you're interested in Henry Clay, Warren Archer lent me this really good biography by Robert Remini. It's kind of definitive, but it's readable. It's one of those great ones that are scholarly and yet you can still read it, and it'll tell you all about that. And in this, he admits that he should have studied more and it would have helped him. But you know, hindsight is always good. Something else about Henry that I guess is worth talking about, and that is his relationship to religion. In a lot of the sources, it says he was a Baptist, and I found that several places. But in this book in particular, there is a quotation where he says that he is not a member of any Christian church. And this was from 1843, and it was made privately. So he didn't do this in a public speech. I think the only thing we can assume from that is that he wasn't an active, practicing Christian. You know, I'm sure he was raised in a Christian home, and I'm sure he was a moral guy, but I don't think he saw organized religion as working for him. And that was a disappointment. I really was hoping to find out something a little bit more encouraging. One of his brothers was a Baptist minister in Missouri. So I think the Baptist line continued, and I assume Elizabeth continued to be a Baptist. But again, we don't know, and the first church built in Versailles was, guess what kind?
Presbyterian.
Yeah, and it's still there, Pisgah Presbyterian Church. But it wasn't long after that, I'm sure the Baptists were already organized. And then, of course, then the Methodist Church was built, and on and so it goes. John.
Is he one of the founding fathers, and why do you think he was a great man? Good questions.
Well, see, my research was not about Henry, so I, yeah. And he wasn't one of the founding fathers, because he was a figure of the 19th century. So he was born in 1777 during the Revolutionary War. So it wasn't until, yeah, after the country was founded. But I would say that he was a very, very important statesman, and he did a lot that we don't have time to go into, but it's worth looking at that really did affect American history. Yes?
He had several compromises.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Beginning in, I think, 1832, I think the last one was 1852, in which he very consciously, I think, devoted himself to prevention.
Right.
Yes,
yes. Yeah. He sort of came around to that idea, and he died in that year. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was obviously a great man, and in Kentucky, he is so revered. And in the 19th century in particular, as I said, just a little bit too much, and we have to take a step back. And in this book, this guy is very much, he's not going with the myth, he's going with the truth. But I think America is a greater country for having had Henry Clay, that's for sure. Yes?
It interests me that you said that she was a disciplinarian to her children. So the discipline, I guess, really paid off his ability and responsibility.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I think so. And of course, that's just what someone said about her, but I think all of her children were successful and productive. There's no evidence to the contrary. And it sounded like she was pretty organized. And yeah, discipline is a good thing. It really is. Yeah, yeah.
Is there any survivors?
Now?
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I thought good about this Clay family archive was that they found this grandson who was elderly at the time willing to write about his grandmother. So I think the family remained very close. And I want to go back to Ashland now and see it with different eyes, I think. Any other thoughts? Especially about Elizabeth going all the way to Kentucky and leaving her child. Yes.
Were there other children left behind?
Well, I think the rest went with them. Yeah. Yeah.
Did she maintain any connections with Virginia after going to Kentucky?
There's no evidence, but I would imagine so. Because she had so many connections. And I think communication and travel was much more active than we tend to think. Even though it was difficult, I think people, they kept in touch with what was going on in Europe even pretty well. So, anything about the role of women at this time? You just think about, were they, one of the reasons we don't know much about her is because they were ignored, maybe?
Mm-hmm. They're there. They're like sort of furniture.
Right, right.
You know what I've said. Yeah. I don't know if that's universal or, it's certainly not that way now, but
yeah. Well, I think it's typical. And Warren and I talked about this, that, and he talked about it last week, a little bit earlier with Hannah Penn. You know, she was a good wife and a good mother, and she did what she was supposed to do, and for the most part, she wasn't noticed until she could be of assistance. What's interesting is this is true, but women were still doing a lot, and that started to pay off in the 19th century, but a little bit after Elizabeth's time. Women, I think, were drawn to these evangelical churches because they were a little bit more democratic, and everyone was accepted no matter what their status in society. In fact, in some of the we might call them high society churches, they were threatened by the Baptist churches and the evangelical Presbyterians. They were afraid that some of their power would be taken away. But it was in these churches that women started finding a more prominent role, and it developed slowly, but then you get the women's missionary movement later in the 19th century. That developed. And during all the 19th century, women were the main ones who went to church. And it was always that way somewhat. But that continued. And so women were like leaders in the church, even though they weren't given, I think, the status that we give them. It was a whole lot more than they had gotten in the 18th century. And then we get them. Some of their programs worked, social programs, they worked really hard on that. Things like temperance, that didn't work out so well later with Prohibition. You know, that probably wasn't a good idea, but that arose out of their frustration with husbands who would go out drinking and end up drunk, you know. And that just bothered them tremendously, as you might imagine. And it was during the 19th century that these churches started frowning upon alcohol. And so then what you would have is the woman in the house having no alcohol served, and then you had the man back in the barn drinking his whiskey. It was really, really, really a challenge, I think, for women. It had just gotten out of control. And so you get the Carrie Nations of the world, and then we got Prohibition and so on. But I think women started to have a more visible role. Yeah. Just took a little time. Eric.
Yeah, I think there was a good deal in those days, in the 17th and 1800s, I think among men, there was a great deal of reverence for the woman in the house and for the mother of the discipline. And the woman who did so many things, I think that reverence among the men went often unreported and unnoted.
So yeah. Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I would call it private reverence.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It was private. And I guess that's how you would describe the role of women and women in the church at that time. It was just private.
Yes.
And they felt that that was proper and appropriate.
Right.
But then you get Elizabeth, who was private, and yet she became an innkeeper. She ran a tavern. I don't know if she poured whiskey and gave it to the guys or not. But still, she became a businesswoman. And I'm not sure she would have done that in Virginia. I have no idea. But I think the rules were a little bit different in Kentucky. And it's also said that Henry Clay got all this polish when he was in Richmond and was invited to all the fancy parties and learned how to dress and speak and so forth. And he lost a lot of that when he moved to Kentucky, probably partly on purpose, so he could get along with everybody. Yes.
Yeah. A lot of times when Glenn Turton has, like John Adams and his wife, through their correspondence, I'm guessing you don't have a lot of correspondence.
No, yeah.
Do you think that might be due to lack of education? Maybe she didn't write, or maybe she just simply didn't have time to write it down?
Or maybe simply the correspondence wasn't saved. I can only imagine they had written correspondence. Certainly Henry to her. I read you what's left, you know, what can be found. And I do think it's odd. And you saw that the Filson Club thought it was very odd that Henry's mother wasn't getting her due attention. Yeah. But again, there were more questions in this than answers. But it's still interesting, and if I want to sum up anything I've learned from it, was that Henry's mother was obviously a good woman, but a strong woman and a woman willing to do new things, such as innkeeping, a woman willing to help the soldiers. She wasn't afraid of what people thought. She didn't mind disagreeing with her father. I mean, they were on different sides during the Revolutionary War, and I know she was close to her father. He was a tobacco inspector at the Hanover County Courthouse. And so she was, I think, a pioneering woman, not in the sense that she was a pioneer, but she really was, and definitely unsung. And then the role of religion that I will continue to think about, being married to a Baptist preacher. And, you know, that wasn't an easy life. He could have gone in a different direction and just farmed. He did this out of some kind of zeal, and he probably had some kind of major conversion experience. And I would love to know more about that. And so I guess I leave you with more questions than answers, but I hope maybe you'll have something to ponder during the coming week. Thank you.